Ja, mich baut der Rest den Appenzeller.
G'day everyone, welcome to another episode of Swiss Pats. Today I am joined by the lovely Louise, who has welcomed me to her home in the little tiny town of Maddettsville. Thank you so much for having me, Louise.
Very welcome. Glad the sun's shining as well.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, lovely day. And so we've decided to sit outside and enjoy the sunshine and the weather. But we've got a tree destruction going on behind us.
Yes, it wasn't there when you were setting up, so I apologize.
We're just going to go through it, aren't we? There it is there. So Louise, we're here to talk about you've got a book coming out early next year. Yeah. Called Just Like Me. It is a book that you've written yourself, and it has four illustrators. So I really, really want to talk about that because it's an awesome book with a great topic. So we're going to get to that. But let's start where I always start with Swiss Pats, which is finding out your story and what you're doing here in Switzerland, because you are from England.
I am from England, yes. So we actually moved here about 9 years ago, nearly 9 years ago now.
It goes fast, doesn't it?
It disappears. So fast. You sort of count it and you're like 6, 7, 8. No, yes, I don't know. Nearly 9 years. My youngest daughter was a year old when we moved over. And we did the whole thing where it was husband's job. I was the trailing spouse.
Yep.
I could blame it on myself because I was the one who suggested, actually, we look for an opportunity because our children were young enough to really, you know, to be able to put up with a move, because kids can adapt really well, and the eldest wasn't going towards senior school just yet. It seemed a good time to try and see what would happen. So we ended up in Switzerland. My husband applied for jobs, actually, funny enough, all around the world. And Switzerland was a perfect fit because my parents actually also live down the road from us, so which I didn't say to you earlier, but yeah,
my
parents
gosh.
Live in Pfaffikon, which is about two villages down the road.
Oh my gosh, so they were already here?
They moved over when I was 16. I was meant to come as well. 2 weeks before the actual move, when all of my stuff was in the lorry, I turned around and said no, and I moved in with my grandmother, so my mother was obviously really happy with that.
And then you came and moved down the road.
And
from
then
her.
I moved down anyways, so it was obviously meant to be. But
there you go.
I needed a few years, obviously, in England before I made
the move. You were ready to do it on your own. Yes,
exactly.
So it was under your own, your choice, basically.
Exactly. Yeah.
So when you made that list of places and that your husband applied for jobs, was there like a preference for where you ended up? Was maybe Switzerland one of those preferences because your parents were here, or was that not a part of your decision making?
Well, my husband's half German. His mum's from Köln, and so for him it was something, you know, he didn't mind German speaking, English speaking. We could have moved to America, Australia. I mean, Australia, he'd lived there for a while when he was younger, and he would have loved to go back there. It was just something, you know, we were both young with young kids, and it just seemed to be a wasted opportunity not to go for it. So
yeah,
we thought, why not? And it didn't seem to be a hard decision at the time. I'm quite spontaneous, so maybe that was a big factor. Let's do something.
Sounds like lots of fun. Like, well, we could end up in any of these countries.
Yeah.
That sounds like fun. For us, when my husband and I moved over, it was just Switzerland.
Yeah.
So I like the idea of, like, which one will come in first? And then and then it was Switzerland that got first past the post.
Exactly. It was quite funny for my husband's family to say, you know, are you sure you didn't move to Switzerland because, you know, of your parents?
Yeah.
He was like, no, we literally applied for jobs everywhere, and it just so happened. And I do apologize, this noise is dreadful in the background. So it's, you know, I'm quite glad that we did end up here, and we came with the understanding it would be 2 years. Or 2 to 3 years. That's how long it would be for my daughter before she would go to the senior school. And that seemed a good sort of trial period. You know, we either enjoyed it and we stayed, or we went back and she would start the whole senior school process in England. So yeah, it was a good time for us to make that decision.
And how about you? What were you doing in the UK before you came to Switzerland?
Well, I was a mum. I was a full-time mum, had three kids, and it was always busy, you know, doing the school runs. I had actually had my eldest daughter when I was 19, so I was a very, very young mum. And, you know, I did a bit of work here and there, but I wasn't really doing anything much. And I was basically supporting my husband's career choice, which was, you know, a lot of hours. And it didn't really fit for me to find work with such young children at home. So
how old are your kids?
Now they are 9, 12 and 16. So the 16-year-old is now working. She works at Kiddyland in Zurich. And she's hopefully going to start her training to do early years teaching, which she'd love to do. So
I can't even imagine having a 16-year-old. It sounds scary.
It's fun. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, she's going to listen to this, so
exactly.
Maybe, yeah. So when you came to Switzerland, how did the kids cope and deal with the move? How old was your daughter, did you say, your oldest
one?
So
my eldest would have been, I think, about seven, eight. And so for her, we were living in another little town called Guttensville, and we decided to put her into the local school. It seemed like a good thing to do, because, you know, the language, we can see how it worked. But it was pointed out actually by one of her teachers that she was having some sort of issues, something I'd picked up actually in England myself, that I thought there was something slightly different to the way she was learning. Something seemed a little off, maybe. And one of the teachers picked it up and said, look, you know, we have support programs, we have things in place to help, but if you are not planning on staying here the long term, it might be better actually to go to an international school, because the support in place, we would do a diagnosis. So we ended up with all of that moving to international school systems for the two older ones. So my other one would have been 4 or 5. When you do the maths,
yeah,
now, is that working out what it was? So yeah, she went into the kindergarten at ICS, and my elder one went into ICS sort of grade 3, I think it was. And yeah, they also continued. I gave them the news that there was maybe something slightly off, and they were having a look and doing some diagnosis. It came out with maybe there was something they weren't sure, maybe some processing issue. But again, I think it's difficult when you're not planning to stay long term to get a full diagnosis or help, or people don't know where to start, really, especially when you've got kids that are also having to settle in a new country. It's difficult to say, is this kid
settling? Yeah, yeah.
Or is there something more going on, and how are things?
Yeah.
So yeah, we had a good few years at ICS. That was brilliant. And then we ended up making the decision that we were staying and had to move our kids again, because we moved slightly further away from ICS and put them back into local systems. We'd made the decision by then that if we were going to stay, they needed to basically integrate. And yeah, that was basically that.
Yeah. So how did those processes of dealing with your daughter and her learning style, how did that happen with the school? Was it an easy process, or was it really difficult?
It's
a bit of a mixture.
It was difficult, I think, for the first few years, because it's been something I was fighting in England. I'd noticed something that was, you know, not maybe right there. And then, you know, as soon as she was old enough, you have to be 7 in England for them to do the whole diagnosis thing. Then we were moving.
Yeah.
So they were like, yeah, maybe not a good time. It can take up to a year. Let's not start.
Right.
And then moving to a country where they said, oh, you're not staying. And it was so difficult, because you've got a kid there who's seemingly doing okay, but there's just something that's just holding her back a little bit. And when we moved into the actual local system, into the Rusikon system, which is where we are now, again, the teachers were great to work with. We had a brilliant, brilliant teacher who, unfortunately, again, she didn't stay long term, but she really did see that Katie was having some issues, and she helped put her forward for an assessment, and it came out that she had Asperger's, which is now known as ASD, or Autistic Spectrum Disorder. And it was a great help, because as soon as we actually knew what was going on, it was easy to find ways to help her, and the school to find ways to help her, because the Swiss system is brilliant, but it's very much one way of learning.
Yeah.
And that happens in lots of countries around the world, so I'm not saying it's just a Swiss thing. But especially, we live in a small village, you know, they just have their one way of doing things. And once we found out, you can't request, oh, I don't like it, could you change it, without having a reason. But mm-hmm. having the reason meant we were able to find a way to help her, which was for her, it was pattern. If she couldn't see a pattern in something, she was lost. This is the girl that could do a jigsaw, 100-piece jigsaw puzzle by the age of two. You know, she could see patterns, but unless she saw it, there was no hope.
Uh-huh.
And by having that diagnosis, the teacher was able to find ways to adapt and to help. And, you know, just, I think people are so wary and so scared of having their kids having a diagnosis of anything because it's a label. And it's a really silly thing because sometimes having that extra, having that extra note on a piece of paper can be the difference of your child maybe doing really well. We've now got a helicopter to
analyze everything. Why not?
Exactly. Anyone else want to join in? But having those little notes on a... On your piece of paper at school just really can help you just get the extra attention you need or support or guidance. And that was a real turning point for us, and we're quite lucky that they were really good with my eldest and getting her the help she needed. It took a while, but we got there in the end.
You feel like that you were having to push it yourself, or were you getting the support right from the beginning, like teachers saying, yeah, we agree and we're going to help with this? It's just that the support isn't there as a whole, but they understood that you needed something. Or were you like, no, keep looking at this, we need to keep going?
I think I fought a lot of it, and I'm still fighting it now because my youngest is as well. You know, she had to go through a diagnosis as well. She came out as ADHD. And there's a lot of fighting. And from the support I've heard from the various clinics and sort of help that's around, they have admitted that, you know, it's still very slow understanding neurodiversity or how people's brain works in Switzerland. It's still quite a slow process. And it's still something that they're learning to adapt. A lot of schools also are very new to integrating even children who are slightly different. You know, if you needed extra support and help, you weren't maybe in the class. And this was one of my, I think it was my middle daughter's teacher who had a coffee and sat down and explained that to me. You know, many years ago, we wouldn't have had someone in who was maybe hearing impaired, or we wouldn't have had someone in who was autistic or ADHD. They maybe would have been put in a specialist school. So it's something that the teachers still haven't got the training with to help. And hopefully this is something that's changing.
Yeah.
And I'm not speaking for all school systems or every school in Switzerland. That would be really unfair. But from my understanding where we were and from the teachers I was speaking to, they were just saying they just didn't have the support in place themselves to even recognize it. So having someone in who could shout and say, excuse me, let's look at here. Can we speak to these people? Was helpful. Not helpful that I didn't speak the language, but you know,
that was going to be my next question about the German, because I think it's a big part of moving to a country like Switzerland, that we always have this language barrier if we come from places like the US, Australia, the UK, because we don't necessarily spend a lot of time learning a second language at school unless we elect to.
Yeah.
So it sounds like that was an extra strain on what you already had to deal with.
Yeah, and I think, and I had this discussion with my husband, who would always be like, you know, you need to learn the language. And I was like, yeah.
Yeah, why wasn't he talking German to you if he's half German?
I mean, I always said this to him. He was like, no, it's weird. But, you know, he gets there, and I understand when you speak to someone and your first language is English, you end up sticking with English. It's a bit weird to introduce it 5 years maybe into the marriage or so. But, you know, it was hard because I was struggling because even if I went to a German class, I wasn't going to be learning all the technical terms. You know, and this was always my thing, you know. And I did say
to myself, I don't need to know how to order beer at the bar. I need to know how to talk to my kids' teachers.
And I said, they'd be really great if someone actually did a German class or a French class or, you know, Italian class for mums. When you move to Switzerland, what do you need to learn? I said, for me, it was like Schlein. That's about snot. It was about... Fever, you know, fever.
Yeah.
You know, what am I going to be talking about?
Right.
Well, I need to be able to speak to the doctors. I need to be able to deal with this. What are the words, the key words? And it always made me laugh. I was saying to people, like, drüsen, that's like, I think your glands as well. Learning all these words were the things which I could have a conversation with a receptionist.
Schmerz, that's always a good one. Yeah.
And once you can speak to people and have these few words, it helps. Because a lot of receptionists maybe don't want to speak English, or can't maybe. And having these few words that you could just shout at them was helpful. But unfortunately, we don't have these specific
classes. There you go. You're onto something.
Now,
so you going through all of that with your children actually sounds like it was a big reason that you wrote this book. So let's talk about Just Like Me, which is a book that you've written yourself with four illustrators creating the drawing. So tell us what it's about, and also kind of elaborate on that reasoning for writing it.
Okay, well, the book is basically a sort of short biography of 40 different people who are neurologically or physically different. And I say different because it's not just maybe disabilities. So we have someone in there who, a child called Nkosi Johnson, who had AIDS, and he was a spokesperson for AIDS when people were avoiding him because he was different. He stood up and said, "Don't be scared of me." We've got people in there who are disabled. We've got people in there who people didn't even know were disabled, like Usain Bolt. People don't realize that he's got scoliosis, and that really shocks people. But he's the world's fastest man. Well, yes he is. It didn't make him any different. It didn't stop him. And it's not saying if you are, you know, different, you know, that you have to do things and you should be doing things. It's just saying that you can, you know, it doesn't have to, a label doesn't have to stop you. Being told that you're one way or another doesn't have to stop you from doing things. And I think for me, with my own journey with my kids, I said, you know, one with autism and one with ADHD, they faced a lot of people going, "Well, you're different." We had a lot of bullying issues. Even my middle daughter had some back pain. She had something called discitis when she was two, which caused her a lot of pain for 8 years. And, you know, when the class would go, "Let's go to a trampoline park," she would give you pain for about 2-3 days afterwards because of the impact on her back. And people would just not understand it. And it was trying to say to people, "It's fine, we can do things, we just have to think about the way we address things." And it was just sometimes met by people who didn't understand or brought certain stereotypes with them. Like, "Oh, your child's got ADHD, or that must be difficult, that must be hard." And I would go, "Well, no, actually, I've got ADHD too. And that's, you can be creative and you're fun and you're imaginative. It doesn't have to be all negative." But because, unfortunately, I think disability and neurodivergent representation is still something that's not talked about very much. We understand the importance of diversity when we talk about the queer community, about, you know, people of colour. We understand how we need to integrate that more into our worlds. But I think disabilities and neurodivergency and just being slightly different for any other reason is still something that people are like, "Oh, mental health, oh, let's, you know," we're still learning. And that's kind of where the book came from, of like, let's try and put a load of people together who are different for various reasons, who are just amazing people and who've done things to change people's perspectives of stereotyping.
That's awesome. So what was your kind of process? Did you start with one story? Did someone kind of strike you like, "Oh, I want to write about this person"?
Yeah.
And then it kind of like, who else could I write about? What was the process there?
Well, I think it was, I hadn't actually planned to write this book. That was the funny thing. I'd actually written a book about dementia and my grandma's dementia journey. And I'd gone to a children's writers conference and it was under my arm and I was really proud. This was going to be the book. And I sat there listening. Again, we've got the helicopter again. We've got a plane now. We've got something else.
Hey, why not?
And I went to this conference and I was sat listening and they were talking again about representation. And it just struck me that, again, as a neurodivergent person, you know, I had ADHD, my stories weren't really out there, and who else's stories weren't out there? And we were talking about representation, and that's why I kind of went home. I started looking at people I'd already shown my children. So Simone Biles has ADHD, and I think she's amazing, and she's just, everyone should know who she is. And then, you know, Temple Grandin, another great person who's got autism. These are people I'd already talked about with my kids, and I already knew were amazing people. So it kind of started with the two of them. I was going to write a book just for neurodivergent people, and then it just spiraled. And people would say, "But what about this person? What about that person?" I'd go, "Oh yes, this person's amazing."
Add it to the list.
Add it to the list. And I think I originally had like 50 people on, and I whittled it down to 40 of, you know, 40 who I think were making a change for the things that they either had as diagnosis or just impacting how things were being done in the world. And that was important for me, just to show, you know, what you can do if you basically, you understand you have a label, but it doesn't have to hold you back, and you just kind of walk through and and talk to people about that. Talking is great.
Yeah.
it's a real door opener, I've realized.
Absolutely. And yeah. you mentioned neurodiversion, and just for, I mean, it was a word that, or a phrase that I had not heard mm-hmm. before. So just explain briefly what that is and the three words, the three phrases that okay. that go with that.
So I would say if you are someone who hasn't had a diagnosis, I hate the word, I said it to you earlier, normal. There's no such thing as normal. But if you're a typical person, there's nothing that's maybe unique, or everyone's unique, but if there's nothing unique or standoutish like an autism or Tourette's, you know, you're basically a neurotypical. There's nothing in your brain that's sending signals for you to do different things. If you are a neurodivergent person, that is someone who is obviously on a different spectrum, so to speak. We are the people who just, our brains just tick a little bit differently, and we think outside of the box sometimes, and yeah, something a bit different. And then the third would be neurodiversity, which is talking about both spectrums, the more typical and the not so typical, and that's drawing all the two together.
And so, it's important to get those phrases out there so that yeah. we learn what they mean, so that when we hear them we can understand yeah. so that we can then continue that conversation.
Because I think a lot of people use neurodiversity, even I used it at the beginning
yeah.
when I was talking about it, and the neurodivergent community was saying, yeah, but that's talking about all the typical people
right.
as well, and that's not our
us?
Community.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you want to talk about our community, it's this. So even I had to learn that because I was on a learning curve.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I only actually got diagnosed as well when my youngest was getting her ADHD diagnosis.
Okay.
That's when
were you kind of like, oh, well, that goes for me too.
Yeah, I was filling out the forms, and because they try and get a few extra people to fill them in, like family members. And my mother was just like, yes, 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 yes. My husband, well, that's you. And I was seeing that as well. And it was actually my daughter's psychiatrist who said, have you considered, you've come in and you talk quite a lot and you tend to go off on different tangents. And have you considered a diagnosis? And I was like, maybe I should. It was between my family and this person. I thought, okay, maybe there's something.
Yeah, does that help having a diagnosis?
It
does
did.
That did that kind of fill in a few gaps for you?
Oh, so much.
Yeah,
it was, I shouldn't have said, but I actually felt like celebrating.
Yeah,
for years.
I've heard that before.
Yeah.
I've heard that from people before. That,
it's,
yeah.
You know, I just felt like I was someone who never fitted in.
Yeah.
Someone who was struggling to find their way. I was struggling where, you know, typical people were able to manage all these tasks, and I was still struggling, and I seemed to be in a little world of my own, and I couldn't work out why.
Mm.
I was too much for a lot of people. I would just bounce into places and they'd be like, whoa, there's this ball of energy. And, you know, it was difficult to work out what was going on. Why was I not able to fit in? Why was I struggling? And I think it was a bit real eureka moment when I found out, because I could actually then read and I could understand and mm-hmm. I could find things to help me, whereas beforehand I was just struggling.
Yeah, and it seems to make so much sense to have that for children, so that mm-hmm. they don't have to wait until they're
yeah.
much older and then wonder about those
yeah.
Those things about themselves, if they can have that diagnosis much earlier.
Yeah, I think it causes a lot of problems for self-esteem. If you're, you know, I was a kid with ADHD who didn't have a lot of friends.
Mm.
Who was told by teachers, you're really great, but was the word that just followed me.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, seeing that with my daughter as well, it was the school again, you know, Emily's great, but, you know, this person's great, but, you know, and it was just like, oh, come on, you know, stop using the but and let's focus on the positive. And it was really difficult because, you know, you're trying your best. It's not that you're trying to be disruptive sometimes, you know, if your brain's not focused on something, you're looking out the window and your pencil drops and you're clumsy, you're not actually trying to be. And
right.
you need the tools sometimes just to help you find your way. It's not about changing who you are. I think a lot of people go, oh, well, you know, you just want the diagnosis to give your kids medicine. That's a big thing I'll just quickly put out there. It's not.
Yeah.
It's about getting a diagnosis and saying, right, what tools do we need to help you now?
Yeah.
And that's important because the school, again, if they're struggling with a child who's maybe not fitting in as they'd like, and they don't have any tools or they don't know where to start, it really does make a difference being able to say, okay, this child is maybe Asperger's, so they need to think this way, or this child has ADHD, so they think that way. And it's something which I believe in heavily, that there's no one teaching style, whether you're neurodivergent or neurotypical, there is no one teaching style. Everyone has something which sings to them.
Yeah.
And that kind of, it'd be nice if it was reflected, but that's taking on a whole new whole new challenge that I don't think I'm ready to take on yet.
So. Maybe one day. But you mentioned that you had gone to a conference with a book under your arm already. So clearly, writing is something that you... that you feel comfortable doing.
Yeah.
So has that always been the case?
I always liked writing silly poems. If anyone had a birthday card for me, I'd always write silly poems in it. I'd enjoyed writing. Never had seen it as something that I would maybe do. I was quite creative. Before being a writer, I was actually a children's entertainer, so I knew how to at least speak to children, so that helped. And I also was the sort of person, I have my sister-in-law, when she was studying to be a teacher, would say, I've got a topic on this, what do you suggest? You know, have you got any ideas? And I was the ideas person. I loved coming up with creative concepts and ideas and ways of approaching things. So writing was something which I hadn't considered. And when I started it, it started because of my grandmother passed away of dementia. And I wanted to write her story. I'd looked at the books that were available when my children had gone through that with me, and you know, how can I help my children understand dementia? And I didn't like the books. They were a very unrealistic point, in my opinion, an unrealistic point of dementia. It was all very much nicey-nicey.
Yeah.
Oh, it's, you know, yes, it's sad, but it missed out all the other sides. It's not just about that grandma's memories have gone. Grandma's also running down the street, probably in her bra and pants. You know, grandma gets angry. Grandma, and I really wanted to find a way of addressing that, and it wasn't being done. Mm. And that's why I kind of started writing. I think I had a bit of a unique point of view because I like a challenging. I like challenging things. As I said, that's why I write Just Like Me. I was challenging people's perceptions of stereotypes. And that was what I wanted to do with dementia when I started. And I think all of my books, when I actually look at what I'm trying to write, they all kind of have a weird sort of way of looking at the world, a unique way. Maybe it's the ADHD comes to me. Maybe that's a positive there. But yeah, something I mean... everyone has their own way to share a story. There's no one right way. I think that, you know, it'd be great if we could, you know, attack different topics a number of different ways to suit a certain parent, because one parent believes this, one parent believes that. There's no one way that we should address things, and I'm not going to start telling people there is. But having options available to parents who want to speak openly, as I shouldn't say, but when we talk about puberty, it's horrendous. You've got a young your daughters yourself, and it's such a difficult subject to talk about. And there are books that deal with it in this lovely fluffy way.
Oh, I know.
And there are books that just go, okay, this is it, this is how it is, boom.
Yep.
And I'm that parent. I am the parent that wants them to have everything and to go with it.
Even the ones that tell it right how it is are still not great. Like, that some of them could still do with some work.
Yeah.
So I mean, there's always room for talking in different ways, isn't there? You're not the only author in your family.
No, I'm not.
Let's talk about very briefly about your daughter. Ellie wrote a book when she was 10 and a half.
Yeah.
So tell us about that.
So this is years ago, and I think I started writing. I was sat down, and they were home because there was either a school day or they're ill or something. Something was happening. And I'm a really horrible parent, and I'm like, go and do something.
Yeah.
You're not just sitting around playing video games. And I got her to sit and write. And this is something actually she came up with. We're talking, this is the lady we're talking about. She's just appeared. So, yeah, she just sat down and she came up with this concept of this girl who moved to Switzerland. It was basically, obviously, her own experience. You know, a girl that moved to Switzerland from England. And something she came up with, which was the words that we find around us and that lost in translation. And she wrote it, so when she was 10 and a half, I had to do a little bit of editing with her, which most of it she did herself. You know, she was doing a reading and writing class, so we got to go through all the grammar together. And we were really in a good position that I spoke to an illustrator who lived in England, and I said, what do you think of this as an idea? Would you illustrate it? He agreed. This guy is Joseph Witchell. And yeah, he took on her book, and it's been transformed. And we've only just 2 years later, it's a bit of a sore point. We finally got it published on Amazon now. So yeah, it was Ellie's point was that, Mum, I wanted to be an author before you. Your book comes out in March. Can I have my
Let's
book out first?
Let's get this one done. Yeah. So congratulations, so, you're officially a published author. Well, I read the book and it's awesome. So that one is called Georgie Moves to Switzerland. So yep. we'll put a link to that as well, so Thank that people you. can see that and get a copy for themselves, especially if they've got kids
yeah.
who are moving to Switzerland or have moved to Switzerland.
Yeah, and it's a picture book, and it has a little activity bit at the back for kids to feel that they can discuss the things they've noticed that are different maybe between where they used to live and where they are now. Yeah, and it was something that it's one of those things you didn't expect it to be a book, you know, yeah. just do some writing. And when you read it and I was like, okay, this is really good. And I think this could be quite helpful and quite funny. It is funny. It's
very funny. Yes. It's very cool.
And, so yeah, it's nice to be able to support kids as well. If they're doing something and they're good at something, then yeah, it's nice to support the next generation of writers or creators, I guess.
Yeah, no, well done. That's really awesome. So we'll link that.
Sorry, now the dog's drinking my water. Yep. We've got the dog here. Everyone's here,
exactly. Going back to Just Like Me, we mentioned that it has a couple of illustrators. So talk us through the process of finding those illustrators and what you had to do and who they are.
Okay, well, I have four illustrators. I have Melissa Iway. I have Angel Chang. I have Katerina, I have to get this bit right, Deli Carey, and Kathy Hookie. Kathy Hookie, actually, I found on a Facebook group. Normally, when you find a traditional publisher, they look for illustrators themselves. But I had specifically asked for people that maybe could relate to things in the book and conversations that we were having. And, you know, just a diverse range of illustrators. And I put a call out on a children's writers group and said I was looking for someone. They were one of the people that came across and said, you know, I'd be interested. And they sent their portfolio to my publisher and they were chosen. And it was really impressive for me that I actually felt like I had a say in one of my illustrators. And they are extremely talented. They actually, funny enough, their aunt lives in Zurich as well, so they have a link to being Swiss, originally from England, now in Texas. And I'm really, really proud of the four illustrators. They have different styles each, and they've really, really found a way to bring out each of the people and the characters I have in my book in the unique style. There's four different, as I said. We've got one that uses watercolors, one that does more digital art, and yeah, hopefully, you know, when I can show you, I haven't got the book here, so you know, hopefully I'll be getting my author copies very soon. But yeah, that's really great, and hopefully I can show you some anyways when we finish the
I'd love to see them.
I can show you a bit online.
So what's the plan for the book? So you said it's coming out in March. What March. Process are you up to at the moment?
So now everything's been done. Yes. Now it's just tick, tick, tick. The book is available for pre-order. So I was really impressed. The first few shops that had the book available were Waterstones, an English one, obviously Amazon. And then Oral Fussli had it, and Press and Books and Luthi Bookhauser, and I was like, oh my goodness, my book is available not only in England but Swiss bookstores have it. And this is before, and I was googling obviously, have any other countries got it in there, but no. So Switzerland obviously hopefully got the note that I was living in Switzerland and wanted to support me. So yeah, everything is available for pre-order at the moment. Yeah, and it comes out in March the 4th. So unfortunately, there's no copies available beforehand. I have to be patient.
Yeah,
but yeah,
that's the hard part.
So hard. It's there. It's nearly there.
And what's the plan in March? You're going to have a big party? Well, I guess might have to be a COVID party.
It's so difficult. I mean, I'm really lucky for the fact that I'm hoping to speak to the guys at Cosmos. I run the Zurich Writers Meetup there weekly. We meet every Tuesday morning, COVID friendly again. If it's COVID safe at the moment, we're on pause because of the numbers. But hopefully they are great, and they want to really support the Zurich writers. So maybe I can do a little something with the writing community and Cosmos, but I'm not holding my breath just yet.
Yeah.
We need to see how things go, and I'd rather not put my heights, you know, the sights up too high and then be disappointed.
Yeah, that's completely understandable.
So, yeah.
Well, I want to congratulate you. It's an awesome subject, and it's an awesome thing that obviously will help a lot of people, and obviously to your daughter as well, who beat you to the publishing train.
She's not reading her own book.
She's got to proofread it, you know, make sure it's all right. So we will link where people can get it, but you mentioned people can get it on Amazon, and if you're in the UK, you can order it on Waterstones,
Amazon, and Book Depository. If you're in Switzerland, said obviously a lot of the Swiss bookstores are stocking it as well.
And then in March, the real copies will come
land on your doorstep. If you pre-order now, they should apparently be on your doorstep for March the 4th, which is very nice.
That
so you don't even
nice.
Have to leave your house; it just arrive there.
COVID-friendly delivery.
Exactly.
Excellent, Louise. Thank you so much for coming on and telling us about it. And we'll link everywhere where people can get a copy of Just Like Me.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yummy bonkerist and off and set.